I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about the proposed controversial right to farm state constitutional amendment that suffered a defeat today in the Indiana Senate. We'll talk about what this means, not just for this session, but for the years ahead. My guests will be Craig Curry of Protect the Harvest, a group favoring the proposed amendment, and Kim Ferraro of the Hoosier Environmental Council, which opposed it. Please join the conversation. Call us at 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is nolimitswfyi, and Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the proposed constitutional amendment regarding right to farm. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Craig Curry, who is the Government Relations and Public Policy Liaison with Protect the Harvest, which supports the amendment, and Kim Ferraro, who is the senior staff attorney for the Hoosier Environmental Council. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Certainly.
And I should say that the Hoosier Environmental Council opposed the amendment, so that we're clear and people understand the balance of the show. And probably ought to start with some news. Everybody here in the studio obviously knows this, but there are people in the world who don't follow the state legislature's activities from moment to moment the way that we do. The legislation, the Senate Joint Resolution 12, that was the proposed constitutional amendment, went down to defeat on third reading in the Senate this morning. So, Craig, I'm going to start first, since this was the initiative that your group was carrying. What does this do to your efforts right now? Where are we? And then we're going to talk about the larger subject of what the amendment was about.
Obviously, we're disappointed that it happened, but we don't look at it as a permanent issue. We'll be back. A very famous old phrase.
Okay. Presumably, though, Kim, it's done for this session?
That's my understanding. Any effort to amend the state constitution through a resolution has to pass two separately elected general assemblies and then go to a voter. So the fact that it is dead this session would mean it has to start the process all over again in another session.
So they conceivably could start it in the 2016 legislative session, right? And then the 2016 election would be the intervening election, and then pick it up again in 2017.
That's exactly right.
Okay. But presumably for this session, and I've learned the reason I'm belaboring point to a degree is I've covered Indiana state politics for, let's just say, way too many years. way too many years. And I learned a long time ago, you don't ever say something is dead. Resurrection seemed to happen on a daily basis over there. So presumably, though, Craig, in terms of the push your organization is doing for this session, is it over?
No.
I mean,
as far as
this session?
I think it's more of an education informational basis where we're at now, because obviously at this point it needs to be resurrected. But as Kim pointed out, we have to go to the next session to be able to get the process started again. It's not a willy-nilly thing to change the Constitution in the state of Indiana. It takes two subsequent sessions in a row to be able to do that. So you really have to plan your way through it.
And an election,
yes,
in between.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's got to be two different legislatures, basically.
Absolutely.
That was the intent. So, Craig, walk me through what this amendment was supposed to do.
it's interesting. In the syllabus, which the legislators really, in the sense, don't have control of the synopsis, if you will, it said right to farm. I think that automatically brings a perspective that whichever side you may fall on, they look at it a particular way. We looked at it as a property rights amendment. There are so many property rights issues out here. The thing that we were so trying to accomplish was to protect and preserve the common law. We wanted predictability and stability in what was going on, which ultimately creates a stable legal environment. And that's really where we were headed. If you look at things, it comes down to changing times create changing needs. And so from our perspective, there's many things going on in this state and around the country that says there's times to do some protections and some preservation of what's actually happening out there.
And what, in specific terms, how would this resolution have amended the Constitution? What changes did you want to see in Indiana's constitutional protections?
We really wanted the common law protected and preserved.
But what common law? What do you mean by that?
When I say common law is the foundation of our constitutions, whether it's state or federal. And it's as the Esquire sitting to my right knows, this would be all the judgments, the laws, and everything that have happened up to this point. Everything goes back to the Magna Carta. And what we wanted to do was make sure that that always operated under that sense, is that you would be able to always count on, remember the words that I use, predictability and stability, rather than getting this thing jerked around. There's 92 counties in the state of Indiana. Do we really want 92 different ways of doing things? It's really up to the people if that's what they want. But you never know exactly how things are going, and there's pressures from so many outside interests that's pushing this along that there's worry on our side.
So, and again, in terms of what the language, when you say the common law that you wanted, what specific practices did you want protected or preserved through this? I mean, what was the language of the amendment?
I actually have that language sitting out in my coat. I meant to bring it in. I forgot to bring it in. It was to make sure one of the things that we see is, I'll give you a very specific one, animal welfare. We see introduced into zoning laws around the state. Animal welfare under Article 7, it's inappropriate. It doesn't need to be there. Zoning is about economic development. Do you want it? Do you not want it? And we're seeing this hybrid where people are starting to do things from a zoning viewpoint. And the thing that we have noticed consistently, it seems like the Planning Commission attorneys aren't talking to the county attorneys. They really don't understand what's happening with those zoning laws. So it's about retaining property rights. You know, it's your property. What do you want? The common good. That's what we were really initially pushing. We're watching this because property rights seem to be something that is being attacked. Any number of counties right now, you'll hear the term excess residential. Mm-hmm. Excess residential, I think, is kind of an interesting thing. I know of a particular family up in Boone County where his property taxes went up $54,000 in 1 year. Amazing. Just because we changed it from agriculture to, quote, excess residential. To me, that and us, that is an attack on property rights.
Kim, what were the Hoosier Environmental Council's concerns in regard to this proposed amendment?
Sure. So I'm going to, there's a lot of things that were just said. So I'm going to just take it back down to the beginning. What SJR 12 would have done would have amended Article 1 of Indiana's Constitution to create a fundamental guaranteed right for farmers and ranchers to engage in, quote, effective livestock production practices or agricultural technologies. It's really, really broad language. So that's what I may have missed a word or two, but that's the essence of the right that would be created. Article 1 of the Indiana Constitution is the same thing That same section of our Constitution where our Bill of Rights are, our freedom of religion, our right to vote, free mm-hmm. speech, those sorts of inalienable rights that we think of as being common to the human condition that are derived from natural law, not something that the government creates. Mm-hmm. I would just say as a fundamental kind of concept to start out the conversation is a specific, special private industry's interest in using its effective industry practices on par with someone's right to vote and freedom of speech? I don't think so. And unfortunately, by elevating an industry practice for constitutional, sacred constitutional protection, what you do is you make it extremely difficult for the government to regulate bad actors in that industry. And there are bad actors in every industry. I think that we both can agree on that. Certainly, the Hoosier Environmental Council recognizes that agriculture is important to Indiana's economy. No one would dispute that. But we also know that with the transformation of agriculture over the last several decades from one of a sort of rural, family-owned endeavor like Old MacDonald's Farm to now big industrial facilities where hundreds of thousands of animals are raised, 10,000 hogs in a place. Have now replaced small farms. And so for folks who, we talk about common law rights, for people who live next to a facility like that, they are the small farmers. They are the ones being impacted. And in fact, we heard in Senate Ag Committee several small farmers mm-hmm. coming in and testifying in opposition to SJR 12 saying, we don't need a right to farm, thank you. What we need is protection from laws like this that give sacred protection, enhanced protection to big outside corporations.
We are talking about the proposed and now, at least for this session, defeated constitutional amendment regarding right to farm. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You also can tumble upon us on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Marion did and reach out to us via Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Marion says, please remember that the effective practices these initiatives protect include animal agricultural practices that would be felonies if committed against companion animals. The 2% of our population's meat-producing giants justify cruel practices with their obligation to feed the world, but it is now common knowledge eating less meat is one of the most effective things we can do to preserve life on Earth. Legalizing current factory farming practices is unconscionable. I would like to see a debate between Farm Bureau and Indiana Farmers Union about these initiatives. Include Indiana Animal Rights Alliance and Indiana CAFO Watch, too. Thanking you for all animals confined. Well, Craig, obviously I'm going to give you a chance to respond to that.
I think the law takes care of that right now. You know, if you would look at Enrolled Act 1468, the last time we touched the animal cruelty laws, it's very specific about what it does. People that abuse animals, absolutely. Let's put them in jail.
Okay, Kim, you're shaking your head, which is effective in personal discourse, but not so much on the radio.
I understand. Well, I didn't want to interrupt.
That's
okay.
No,
want to be polite. So most of our, and I don't practice in the area of animal law, but I do know that generally most animal cruelty laws totally exempt farm animals from the same sorts of practices, inhumane treatment that we would consider inhumane to a domestic animal, to our dogs and cats. And so what we have is an institutionalized practice that a lot of folks have issues with. For example, the use of gestation crates for sows where the animal cannot for its entire life turn around. The use of battery cages the size of a piece of paper where the egg-laying hen can't even spread their wings. So these are common legal practices that are not banned under cruelty laws that a lot of folks think are inhumane. And regardless of what you think about that, those are the types of practices that would have received constitutional protection under SJR 12.
Is one of the concerns, Kim, that that I'm hearing from the Hoosier Environmental Council here too, was that for these practices that a constitutional amendment would have established a constitutional defense against any sort of prosecution or investigation?
Well, not only that, the express language of the right prohibits the Indiana General Assembly from passing any new laws that the industry would argue are unreasonable against its what it deems to be effective practices. And just to take this outside of the animal welfare realm, we know from a recent United Nations report that there are significant environmental impacts associated with these practices that I'll talk about in the next segment.
We are talking about the proposed right to farm constitutional amendment here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Craig Curry, who is the Government Relations and Public Policy Liaison with Protect the Harvest, which favored the proposed amendment, and Kim Ferraro, who is the Senior Staff Attorney of the Hoosier Environmental Council, which opposed it. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about the proposed state constitutional amendment establishing a right to farm. Went down to defeat in the Indiana Senate this morning, but one of our guests, Craig Curry, who is the Government Relations and Public Policy Liaison for Protect the Harvest, and which favors the proposed amendment, says that it will be backed. My other guest is Kim Ferraro, who is the Senior Staff Attorney for the Hoosier Environmental Council. If you'd like to join the conversation, why don't you do what Pamela did and shoot us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Pamela says, I have been inside a confinement system. I also have assisted my husband, who is a veterinarian, for over 40 years. He says confinement is bad business for everyone, especially with the possibility of people getting disease from living within the same area as a confinement system. There is a reason they used to let the animals roam around the nation. It is healthier for them as well as us. Who is doing the studies on the human water, air, and land contamination on confinement systems? Craig, I'll let you take that one first, and then let Kim weigh in as well.
I really sit down and look at that as the fact of how are we ultimately going to feed everybody. I really do. We have to feed 9 billion people in the next 43 years, and yes, I appreciate and respect this person's opinion. But you know what? It's not American Gothic anymore. You know, the person sitting there with the pitchfork and going, this is farming. I find it fascinating that one of the things that we sat and watched through this was turning small farmer against large farmer, that everything was big ag, factory farms. We just don't see that happening. We really don't. The health conditions and things, when I look at all the protections, and when I look at everything that's going on, I don't see it the same way. Nor we just don't.
Kim.
Sure. 2 points. I've heard this argument in favor of SJR 12 that we need to feed the world, and that's why agriculture needs this sort of protection. But the facts just really don't bear that out. What we need to add to the sentence is we need to feed the world, yes, but we don't need to feed the world animal protein in the form or at the same rate that Americans are eating animal protein. I mean, we don't all need to have triple bacon, double cheeseburgers. And, you know, if you think about to your grandparents' time, eating meat was sort of a delicacy. It cost more, and that's because the external costs in society were actually internalized by the cost of production. And I'd like to give listeners a couple of facts about that. To produce 1 pound of meat takes 2,400 gallons of water versus 1 pound of vegetables that takes 20 gallons of water. So we could feed the world if we were all more reliant on plant-based protein versus animal-based protein. So that's one problem with that argument about feeding the world. The other thing is that we continue to hear is that IDEM most strictly regulates agriculture than any other Midwest state. That also is not really quite true. Yes, IDEM goes beyond what the federal EPA requires, but the federal EPA doesn't really require much because of recent federal court decisions that have gutted EPA authority. What our regulations cover strictly is runoff from a lagoon or a manure storage structure and runoff from a production facility. It does not account for runoff from farm fields where manure or livestock waste is sprayed and applied. That is not considered a discharge. This idea of zero discharge is really a fallacy. The other thing is that our regulations don't regulate odor, nuisance problem, dust, insects, vectors. None of that is regulated under current regulations, so there are significant gaps in policy.
We are talking about the proposed state constitutional amendment to establish a right to farm. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Richard, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I've been interested in this area for some time from a public health standpoint. Confined feeding operations, especially pigs, produce huge amount of manure. Much of this manure is contaminated with antibiotic-resistant organisms because of the antibiotics and other growth promoters are fed to the pigs. Now, what is allowed is to spread this manure, as Kim just pointed out, over fields under essentially no control. The amount of manure produced by some of these pig farms is equal to the amount of waste produced by a small city. Now, no one would permit a city to go out and spread its untreated sewage over the landscape in the surrounding area. And that's what is permitted in Indiana at the present time. IDEM does not do a good job of monitoring the streams. There's good evidence that some of these streams are contaminated with all sorts of different organisms, but we don't know how much, and there's essentially no effort to find out. There have been studies done in, I don't remember, South Carolina or North Carolina that bears this out. So this is really not just a right-to-farm problem. Farming is good. We need farming, but we do not need what are essentially industrial facilities built in rural areas that mass grade under farming. Some of these are built next to schools. The manure is spread next to schools. They cause significant odor problems. If the small farmer has a farm and one of these CFOs goes in next to him, his quality of life is significantly disrupted just by the odors from those CFOs. We need to do something about this before it turns into a significant public health problem because of the antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call, Richard. Craig.
I really don't know how we address this. I think what this came down to, once again, is SGR 12. The bottom line was to get it in front of the citizens of the state of Indiana and say, what do you want? What don't you want? I know of a facility, I'm sure Kim knows about it as well, that came to Wayne County where there was chicken manure as a satellite plant, came to Wayne County. Ohio has 750 million tons that can't be in Ohio. That came there. No one in the state of Indiana had any chance to do anything about it. That was done by the federal government. How we deal with this, I'm not sure. It's interesting. People are unhappy about the chemicals. They don't like what's being done to the land. I don't think anybody does. But we sit there back and forth. There's different studies that go both sides. What's better for the land? Is manure better for the land? Are chemicals better for the land? If neither one is good, what do we do? What do we actually do?
Well, let me ask, because it seems to me that there's a theme with the calls and to some degree Kim's concerns too. I shouldn't say they may be personally Kim's concerns, but they're actually the Hoosier Environmental Council's concerns as well, which is at some level what this amendment does is protect or isolate an industry in the largest sense of the word in this state from any ongoing attempts at regulation. Is there a way to address that concern by modifying the language, Craig? Are there changes that your group and the folks who are in favor of this amendment would entertain to address the concerns that are being stated here?
I think if there was a true discourse, a true dialogue, I always believe that good people can work out good things. You know, it goes back to kind of my opening statement, changing times create changing needs. Mm-hmm. And so that's where we're at. How do we address this? There has to be a dialogue. I find it very interesting when we keep talking about small farm, large farm, factory farm, corporate farm. I'm always stunned by that conversation. Corporations, everybody has a corporation. People in my apartment complex have corporations because they did it to protect mm-hmm. themselves. The small farmer needs the protection just as much. The person that wants to do free-range chickens absolutely needs to have the right to do it. I know of rural counties, rural cities where they can't have a chicken at their house, but it's rural. Everybody needs some kind of protection in this. They do, because they're constantly under attack. We are farming with less farmers, less people. There's a particular facility up north, 54,000 cows. People go, why do they need 54,000 cows? Look at the price of milk. Look at the subsidies there. We talk about hogs. Why did the Chinese buy Smithfield Farms? Why did they even do it? Why would they buy the largest producers of hogs in the world? Why would they do that? Obviously, they want to feed their people. It's a difficult problem. Could we all sit together and work this out? I think we could.
Kim, I'm going to flip that around. Presumably, you know, the Hoosier, we'll take the premise of Craig's argument here, that this is about property rights. I'm assuming that the Hoosier Environmental Council isn't mounting a full-on assault on the idea of property rights. Are there changes in the language that might conceivably make this acceptable to the Hoosier Environmental Council that would, you know, deal with the questions of predictability that Craig has raised and said, and, you know, really, he's talking about predictability, he's also talking about uniformity, that, you know, you don't want to have to worry about going from one county to another and what the different regulations might be. Are there ways that those concerns could be addressed and to some degree institutionalized?
Sure. That's a really good question. I think I would flip it back to Craig, though. And I will answer as well, but I want to bring one more little factor into the mix here.
Yeah, I was going to say, I can tell I'm dealing with two trained advocates here. There. Yeah.
Well, last year we had this same discussion, actually, over a new law that passed, Senate Enrolled Act 186. And when it was Senate Bill 186 last year, we heard the same arguments why Senate Bill 186 was needed, that agriculture is under attack, that we need Indiana needs to protect its producers, small and large, that there are people out there, groups, well-funded groups, that don't like the way, you know, animals are treated. And so we need to ward off any regulation because they're trying to get Hoosiers to not eat meat. I mean, we have to feed the world, all of these same arguments. And you know what? The General Assembly passed that law. It's been on the books now for 1 year. That law reads that the entire Indiana Code, our whole statutory scheme, has to be construed by courts, zoning officials, plan commissions, BZAs, IDEM, all state agencies that have any sort of official duty to interpret the Indiana Code, to construe it in a way to, quote, protect the rights of farmers and ranchers to engage in effective livestock production practices and agricultural technologies. How then, I would ask Craig, how does that law not give the protection that his group and constituents are seeking? That law hasn't even been around long enough for there to be a test. So are we going to go and take the drastic step of amending the Constitution, which, quite frankly, would shut down any sort of conversation about what do we do? He says, you know, what do we do about these problems? Enshrining a right for one industry pretty much shuts down that conversation about what do we do and protects the industry so that it can make the decision about what we're going to do without anybody else being a part of that conversation.
Okay, and quickly, is there any language or are these, no, in all, you know?
Not by amending the Constitution. I think we can have, I agree, we should
within
have
within code there would be, though, within the current legal code that would be subject to revision, Indiana.
Yeah, I'd like to have a conversation about how the current legal code doesn't already do that.
Okay. We are talking about the proposed constitutional amendment to establish a right to farm in Indiana. It went down to defeat this morning in the Indiana Senate, but is clearly going to be an ongoing issue. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Pam, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm a small family farmer, and our family has farmed for generations. I don't need protections for farming. We have a nice, clean operation. The neighbors and I get along just fine. The idea of messing with the law of our state constitution, now that is something that is very scary. All kinds of things can happen. This is a dangerous move with the possible misuse of our natural resources. Indiana is a great state. So here's my question that has really bugged me through this whole process. Why are senators and representatives who own confinement systems and operations that stink up the farm environment and pollute the water and use so much water, why have they been allowed to bring this to the State House when they themselves clearly will gain personally from changing the way the law is now? Shouldn't they excuse themselves from this process at the State House?
Thanks very much for the call and the question. Pam, I'm going to throw that one to Kim first.
That is a great question, and I think that we're not dealing with a court of law here. We're dealing with the legislature, where there is no professional ethics rules that would prohibit a farmer or an environmentalist, for that matter.
Yeah, their argument historically has been it's a citizen legislature.
Correct.
We have to make a living.
But
yeah.
Certainly, I mean, that is a legitimate concern when you see efforts like this. I would say that it's more an undue influence of big lobbyists and well-funded agribusiness groups that are able to have too much influence over our legislators.
And we've got an email from a listener named Omo. If you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. I'm going to abbreviate the email because we've got a lot of calls and we're getting a lot of Facebook and email questions. And just get to the question at the end, which says, can you tell me which corporations are driving this amendment claiming they are helping family farms? Craig, I'm going to throw that one to you.
We have absolutely no ties to any corporations. I can say that assuredly. It's been interesting as things have been in the press. Oh, this was Big Ag, and they've named certain names. Us. Didn't see a dime. A dime.
Is Protect the Harvest a 401c3?
You mean a 501c3?
I'm sorry.
I understand. There's a
the cold medication clearly is kicking in right now.
Yes, sir. So. There's a 501c4 and a 501c3, both.
Okay, and who provides the bulk of the funding then for your 501c3
side? Mr. Lucas, Forrest Lucas.
Okay, so, and he has a significant agribusiness.
Yes, he does. Well, right. from this viewpoint, he has the Lucas Cattle Company in Missouri.
Okay, and is he provided the bulk of the funding? The distinction between 501c3 and 501c4 is that on the C4 side you can lobby, and the money that runs through it is not tax deductible.
Absolutely.
Who's provided the bulk of the funding for the C4 side?
I can assuredly tell you it was him.
Okay, all right. That I think is what the listener's question was about. We have also gotten in terms of this question, I'm not going to throw it because we're approaching a break. I'm not going to throw a complicated question at you right now. But, you know, has the fact that small farmers do seem to be concerned about this at least told you, Craig, that you've got to do a little more outreach with them?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes, because I think the other side may have done a better job. I think the message is there. I truly see it as the message was there.
We are talking about the proposed state constitutional amendment that would establish a right to farm here on No Limits. My guests are Craig Curry of Protect the Harvest and Kim Ferraro of the Hoosier Environmental Council. I am John Kroll. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about the proposed state constitutional amendment that would have established a right to farm. It went down to defeat in the Indiana Senate today on third reading, but we'll be back as one of our guests, Craig Curry, who is the government relations and public policy liaison for Indiana for Protect the Harvest, a group that supported the amendment. And my other guest is Kim Ferraro, who's the senior staff attorney for the Hoosier Environmental Council, which opposed the amendment. We have got a lot of calls, emails, and all of that. So I'm going to ask both my guests and the people who have questions to be as concise as possible, both in their questions and their answers. Margaret, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm not a vegetarian, but I don't eat a lot of meat, and I try to shop local and organic, but not strictly. So I think I'm a middle-of-the-road Hoosier. I just want to ask, it was something that the gentleman from Protect Our Harvest said about we have to feed the people of the world. But I would say, I would add to that, but we have to do it sustainably. We can't just feed them the next year or two. We have to do it in the future. So how does limiting the ability of individual property owners, communities, and the state to adapt to the changes in the climate, environment, economy, help us do that sustainably going into the future?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Margaret. Craig.
We didn't look at it as that it was limited. We actually thought it was helping it. I mean, the biggest thing here was not just looking down at the end of your nose and saying what's going to happen next year. Or the year after, what's going to happen 5 years from now? What's going to happen 10 years from now? What's going to happen to my grandkids, my great grandkids? That's where we were really looking at.
We've gotten an email question from a listener named Elizabeth, and if you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. Elizabeth says, and I'm going to synthesize this, that really SJR 12 would have limited people's rights who are not large farmers to contend with you know, the effect, harmful effects that would come to their property. And she concludes with a question that's directed to Kim, saying, Ms. Ferraro, can you please speak to the property rights of those who live next to and suffer the health environmental impacts of living near a factory farm, or people's inability to protect themselves from factory farms moving in 300 yards away from their homes?
Sure, absolutely. In fact, I have personal experience with this in representing a farm family who was driven from their home for over a decade because their neighbor sold to a confined feeding operation. And unfortunately, under existing law, we've got a Right to Farm Act that was passed back in the early 80s that addresses this whole property rights issue. It precludes almost exclusively the ability of a property owner to sue a livestock operation for nuisance, except in very limited circumstances. And that law was enacted back then to prevent urban sprawl, people moving from the city out to the country not liking the smell. Unfortunately, it's been co-opted by these large factory farm operations to shield themselves from liability for causing those sorts of harms.
We are talking about the proposed state constitutional amendment to establish a right to farm in Indiana. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Malin. Welcome to
yes,
the program.
Sir. Ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate it. Thanks for the opportunity.
Certainly. I hope I got your name right.
Yeah, just like sending a letter.
Okay,
at least
good.
The way we pronounce it in Indiana, anyway.
Good.
And I'm the guy that lives in southwest Wayne County, literally across the street from the poo storage. I'll clean it up for radio here, where all the chicken manure is being brought in from the St. Mary's watershed. And, yes, it does have an impact. The number of trucks... we've been treated to the lovely smell. They started loading the thing just before Christmas when it was still a little warm, And the problem for both and me is I tend to be a very libertarian person, and my point is that I think people ought to be able to do what they want with their property with a minimal amount of conflict with the government. But the way it stands right now, the feds are shipping this stuff and encouraging and paying for shipping this stuff over here. The government's giving money to put up such a structure. I'm prohibited from doing all kinds of things here by zoning. This guy is not. Indiana's flat-footed about it. And my concern is this. Getting into the study of what's in poo and the confined feeding operations, there's a lot of things that are in the manures that are have to be spread. It has to be put somewhere. And I think his name is Craig, the gentleman there. We've used manure for years, no problem. I'm a small farmer myself. But the point is that you put all these metals, toxins, antibiotics, and so on the soil, and at some point, I'm afraid that the government is going to bust the farmer out and say, clean up your fields, and or we're going to take it, or we're going to fine you. And so we're caught between the powers of big government coming and going. I'm on both sides of the issue, even though I'm directly in front of the manure truck, so to speak.
I'll let Kim have the first crack. I will say that that Craig was doing a thumbs up when you were talking at the end there, Malin. Thank you very much for the call.
All right.
I'll be quick. I think that what the caller was referring to are with respect to incoming waste from other states is these new satellite manure storage structures that are being built in Indiana to store this outside waste. And if SJR 12 were enacted, it would actually prevent the state of Indiana from going forward with some new regulations that it's considering to help reduce the impacts of this incoming waste. So actually would have a perverted effect that would increase the harm that this caller is talking about.
Craig.
Malin and I had talked before. Actually, I was glad to hear from him. This was the federal government that funded all of this. I find it fascinating that there were people that tried to stop this. I think there were people on both sides that said, hey, you know, we'll take ours. We're not necessarily good with yours. You know, and that Malin had a very unusual presentation that I saw, and that's when he said he cleaned it up. But what do you do? I don't believe that what SJR 12 does would have stopped this. This was a bigger issue. This is the federal government. How do you stop that?
Kim, I'm going to give a real quick last word.
It wasn't the federal government. What happened is Ohio has strengthened its regulations and is addressing the very issue that we're talking about here in Indiana. And so because of their strengthened regulations, we're getting the waste because they don't want to put it in their waterways.
So, in effect, it's an interstate commerce issue that you can move across the line and to support Kim's point here that if you consider that sort of activity sort of like water or fluid, it's going to find wherever the crack is to flow through. And in this case, Indiana seemed to be the crack. We've gotten an email from a listener named Eric who says, according to the U.S. EPA, there are more than 313 million people living in the United States. Of that population, less than 1% claim farming as an occupation. If of that 1%, it is only the bad actors who are causing problems for neighbors, why is a constitutional amendment necessary to protect their rights to be bad actors? Craig, I think that one's pitched right at you.
It is. Like I said, not about tomorrow, not next year. This was about looking forward. We want to make sure. Let's deal with the bad actors. No matter what industry it is, you always want the bad actors to go away. There's so few of farmers that are out there. To his point, 1%.
Well, then how would I'll take that. How though, if this amendment were to become part of the Indiana Constitution, how then do we go after the bad actors? I mean, what is the process for doing that?
It changed no existing law. Read the last paragraph of SJR 12. It didn't change any existing law. And they had to think about what they were doing going forward. Kim, those bad actors could have been dealt with.
Okay, Kim, you're disagreeing.
Yeah, so existing law is already failing to deal with bad actors, as we're hearing in several anecdotal stories today, and certainly I can speak to that personally. So existing law is not addressing it, and this would prevent the General Assembly from enacting new laws. So basically tying the hands of state regulators and the Indiana General Assembly from taking further action against bad actors. So I don't see how amending the Constitution to give a special right to the bad actors and then tying the hands of state government to do anything about it actually helps us address bad actors.
We are talking about the proposed state constitutional amendment that went down to defeat in the Indiana Senate this morning that would have established a right to farm. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Margaret, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you very much. My question is regarding scale and magnitude of scale. In the agricultural industry at this point, the problems of a huge magnitude, including the public health that the earlier caller mentioned, they're all coming from the industrial corporate farmers with intensive density of echelon. So why can there not be a law limiting or regulating that impact? It's scale is the key here. The interests of the small and moderate size traditional farmer are in no way similar to the corporate, industrial, huge situations of which we're talking. And my own anecdote is coming back from Lafayette last fall, I was driving on 421 toward Indianapolis and was and I had the windows open. It was a gorgeous fall day. I almost drove off the wall as this disgusting, overpowering smell took over, and I turned, you know, went around the curve, and there was this incredibly huge industrial, I don't know what was inside, but I do know it was animals. And once I smelled it, I thought, oh, my gosh, on that alone, this should be addressed. How in the world people live around that is disgusting. Their rights are being overrun. And I hear no balancing of rights and interests being discussed by Ken. You're a nice guy and all. But and talking about decades down the road now is... Thank you for the overall thought, but that's not what's going on. And you don't destroy the present to protect, you know, something that we don't even know will exist or not 50 years from now.
Margaret, let me give Craig a chance to respond, but thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
Margaret, thank you for the question. I look at when we were in committee for SJR 12, Kim was there as well as I was, but during the middle of it, one of the senators brought up a point. There were 40 permits, period, last year, 40. And that was across the whole board. There was 53 who had not renewed their permits. That's a net loss of 13. Yet I keep getting told that this is a horrible, horrible, horrible problem that is just going on and on and on. I understand. People don't want to smell what they don't want to smell. There, if there's something we need to do, let's sit down and let's figure out what to do.
Kim.
Yeah, I've heard that number about the number of permits being issued. That doesn't take into account the size of the operation being permitted. What we're seeing is fewer permits and fewer farms, but vastly expanding size of farms with respect to the numbers of animals. The amount of livestock that Indiana produces, the number of animals that we raise has not been reduced.
Got an email from a listener named Kobe that says, there is overwhelming evidence that factory farms do great harm to the environment and that Hoosiers are not supportive of this agribusiness. Why then do our legislators vote in favor of them? Let's take the statement first. I mean, is the evidence as overwhelming as Kobe suggests, Craig?
We don't believe so.
Okay. Do you have evidence that would contradict that, or Kim?
I can read you some statistics if we have time.
Sure. We've got a little bit of time.
Okay. So recently the United Nations, the farming piece of the United Nations, came out with a report. It's been relied on by the US EPA and the WWF. And here's what we know. that livestock production alone is responsible for more water pollution than all other industrial sources combined. It's responsible for 85% of soil erosion in the United States. It's responsible for 51% of global greenhouse gas emissions, more than transportation, more than any other source combined. It's the leading cause of species extinction, and it's more damaging to the environment than just about anything we do. And so by giving blanket constitutional protection for practices that are causing this magnitude of harm is just quite frankly irresponsible.
We are talking about the proposed state constitutional amendment that would establish a right to farm. Mary, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. I think we probably all remember from high school and college George Orwell's metaphor, allegorical novel, Animal Farm. And I would ask Craig, it would appear that some pigs are more equal than others. You remember that one? And it would seem that the larger CAFOs have more rights, property rights, than the neighbors' rights to when you cope with property rights in your constitutional amendment. It doesn't seem it takes into account the right to clean air, clean water, and a right to enjoy your own property. How would you comment on that?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Mary.
I remember the book very well. We do believe it takes care of that. We honestly think that it does. This, neighbors work with neighbors. Somebody doesn't want to be there, don't be there. I understand the problem.
Well, and I guess where I'll take Mary's question and say, how do you balance within this construct the property rights of others? That's really what she was asking about, is where is the balancing test here? This resolution would establish a clear set of property rights for the farmers, but what about the people who live next to the farmers? Do they have rights as well?
Yes, they do.
Okay, where would those be established or enshrined? Or do we need another constitutional amendment for those?
I hope we don't.
But
I don't think we do. I don't think we need another set of rights.
Kim, I'm going to give you the last word here.
Okay. Well, clearly under existing law, property rights of neighboring landowners are already being impacted. And so in giving, as you pointed out, John, extra special protection to farmers and ranchers who are eroding.
Well, I was posing the question. I wasn't pointing it out.
Okay. Asking the question. I definitely don't want to put words in your
mouth. Okay, yeah.
This definitely tips the balance away from protecting property rights of landowners who are being harmed.
I am not sure we have resolved anything here today. But given the fact that this issue clearly is not going to go away from everything that we have heard, I'm guessing we could have a livelier conversation about this next year, and I hope you will both come back maybe when this earlier in the session so that we can talk about it. I'd like to thank my guests, Craig Curry of Protect the Harvest and Kim Ferraro of the Hoosier Environmental Council. I'd like to thank all of our listeners, and especially those who sent us questions. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatch. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.